I'm Jill Anderson. This is the Harvard EdCast. Tiffany Hogan is on a mission to educate about a common and yet hidden language disorder many children have called developmental language disorder, or DLD. She's the director of the Speech Language Literacy Lab at MGH Institute in Boston. Although more children have DLD than autism, most of us have never ever heard of DLD. It can impact children's ability to learn on many different levels. Tiffany spoke to me about that and why she's pushing for greater awareness of the disorder.
Developmental language disorder is the low end of the distribution of language abilities. So children have a range of abilities on lots of different abilities. So if you think about the child's motor abilities, their cognitive abilities, we have lots of different abilities, attentional abilities. Language ability is the ability to understand and use language. And we have a normal distribution. So we have persons in the population that are really, really good at it. And you could think about someone who knows lots and lots of languages and they learn words really easily. But then there's the lower end of the distribution, and those are children who have difficulty learning languages. It's a neurobiological difference. So children are born with this. The range is 7 to 9%, and it can go up to 10. I usually say it's about 1 in 12 children have this difficulty in learning language in their primary language, also other languages. And this means that they have difficulty understanding and using language, but it's often a hidden impairment because it's not so obvious when a child's not understanding you. It can be misinterpreted as attention deficit. It can be misinterpreted as laziness. I've heard parents say, well, I just thought he wasn't interested. It can be misinterpreted as a social issue. But as speech language pathologists, this is our area where we study speech and language development of children. And we've done several longitudinal and epidemiologic studies that show that about 1 in 12 children have this difficulty. And unfortunately, it's often hidden, but it has a huge impact on a child's life. And only about 30% of children ever get the diagnosis. And so this is something that children can live with, and it's undetected. It can be detected later as a specific learning disability because language permeates all of what we do. It's the foundation of learning. So it can be diagnosed then, but it's a little late. We want to diagnose it early, at the beginning of school, ideally, in the preschool years. And if we don't diagnose it early, it can create a lot of shame in the child themselves, and they can make decisions or feeling really down about themselves and academic performance if they don't have the support they need.
Right. You're talking about this being something that's hidden.
Yes.
So how do you even recognize this in maybe your own child or if you're a teacher working with kids?
So in the past, that 30% that receives a diagnosis and is not hidden, their parents know about it, the school knows about it, they typically have some type of other problem that brings them to the attention of the teacher or the speech pathologist. So, for instance, those who are identified often have a comorbid or co-occurring speech sound disorder. So they may use immature speech to produce words. That's different than a language disorder. The speech production, that has to do with producing speech sounds. But if a child has difficulty producing speech sounds, that can be something very obvious that the teacher may say, I'm not understanding this child. Then they are referred for a speech and language evaluation, and they'll do the language evaluation and uncover this hidden deficit. Another one that happens quite often is if the child has a co-occurring ADHD, they act out in the classroom or they have more obvious attentional problems, they'll go get a full evaluation. And they'll say, oh, lo and behold, they also have a language deficit. Or maybe it was a language deficit, and that was what was causing the acting out, which can be true if you're having difficulty understanding. You can look quite inattentive. The other factor that we know influences whether a child is identified is having a mother with high education. That's a common factor. And we're not exactly sure why that is the case, but we hypothesize it's because that mother maybe is reading a lot of information and maybe just goes to the pediatrician and says, I want a full evaluation. If a child is referred for a full evaluation with a language impairment, ideally, that full evaluation should include a language assessment, and then the impairment will be identified. What we're advocating for is universal screenings of language. This can be done in kindergarten. So we screen for hearing impairment. We screen for vision impairment. We now have laws across the United States to screen for word reading deficits associated with dyslexia. we are hoping to capitalize on those laws to screen for dyslexia and to add in screening for developmental language disorder. And my lab has been working on a group screener, so it's actually not horribly difficult and doesn't take that much time. We have a screener we've developed that you can give to a full classroom of kindergartners in about 20 minutes that can give us an idea of whether a child's at risk. And then we take those at risk and we do a more full evaluation. So if we can get these more universal screeners in place, we can actually uncover this hidden deficit and provide those children and parents the education and support they need.
That's so interesting. I have never thought about language screening. Is that something hard to do? Because it seems almost like an easy solution.
It's actually quite easy. As a field studying language disorders, yeah. We've been thinking a lot about the markers of language impairment and how do we discover these. And there's a lot of work. So we have a strong foundation now to pull from. Mm-hmm. And it's really just, as speech-language pathologists and language researchers, thinking about how we can implement the work that we do. There's always, unfortunately, a gap between what we know in research and what's implemented. And there's a whole field, implementation science, where we look at how do we translate what we know in research to practice. And this is one of those examples. It also has to do, I think, with understanding what screening brings you. So screening would be looking for warning signs. There would still have to be more testing, but it actually fits really nicely into the educational system now because we do have more of the screening model that's set up, and so we need to push that for language.
I just want to back up a little bit to when you were talking earlier about how you might see signs of this. It is hidden. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that it's often mislabeled or misdiagnosed as just a kid being lazy or attention issues. We're talking with young kids, you know, and I'm imagining this is better to diagnose when they're younger.
Absolutely. What's tricky is that we have a large variation of language skills early on. That variation reduces a bit as children get older. But let's take, for example, a two-year-old. So a two-year-old is starting to develop a vocabulary. First words occur around 12 months, but there's a range. Some children don't get their first words until 18 months. That's also not abnormal. So children are developing their first words. And two, we start to see this burst of vocabulary development. They start to use more words. They start to use two and three word combinations. But the range of vocabulary you'd spec for a two-year-old, for instance, is 75 to 225 words. That's a huge range. It also requires parents to write down with vigilance all the words that their child is using. When you do that, you often see it's more than you think. There's been a lot of work looking at children we call late talkers. Mm. So late talkers are those, by definition, who have less than 50 words at age two and no two-word combinations. However, you'd think, well, that might be a good indication of a language disorder. But only about 25% of late talkers go on to have a language disorder. That shows you the variability. 75% kind of outgrow late talking. So this is tricky because of those who have a language disorder, most, if not all, were late talkers, but only 25% of late talkers have a language disorder. So it gets really tricky. So what I say is if you have concerns, your child's a late talker, for instance, and you have some concerns, getting evaluation is really the best approach because you really need to take a look at the whole context. What's the speech development? What's the cognitive development? What's the language development? And try to get a full evaluation through your pediatrician or local school districts have early intervention. You can get an evaluation there, or your insurance company can give referrals. But if there's a concern, it's best to get the evaluation. We do know that as children get a little bit older, for instance, 3 and 4 year olds, they start using more complex grammatical aspects. So they put together longer sentences and they start to, for instance, say the dog ran versus the dog runned. You know, those kinds of things. They start to figure out the grammar of the language. And that's a real difficulty for children with language disorders. That's one of the key markers. But it's interesting because they tend to not make errors that are abnormal, but they tend to hold on to the immature patterns longer. So it can also make it a little bit tricky. And then there's the understanding part, right? So following directions, you know, two-step directions. These are some of the signs of early language impairment, but ultimately you need to have an evaluation to really figure it out.
And so in a child who has this developmental language disorder or DLD, Tiffany, what does that actually look like in those scenarios?
Mm-hmm. I think this is why it's often hidden, because these children are developing, most of them are just developing typical in every way.
Right.
This is an outlier for them. So this language ability, they could be developing, you know, they're walking as they should, they're doing very outward things. Many of them even produce speech sounds, as you would expect. So it's not an obvious difference. So what they look like is they have more immature language production. They have difficulty understanding, especially multi-step directions. You may tell them to go get their shoes, their socks, get their backpack, grab their coat. They do a couple of those, but then they forget the last one. And this is tricky because that can also be seen in ADHD. So there's a lot of overlap until you dig a little bit deeper. They do have difficulty learning vocabulary. So let's say you teach a new word to them and it seems like they don't remember it the day later. It takes them longer to learn new vocabulary words. That's another really key factor that we know about these children. But the tricky part is it's not obvious. They're functioning in many, many ways very typically. Social skills can be also very typical. Some of them even have extraordinary social skills, and we argue maybe as a way to compensate for not understanding. So you look at these differences in language that are can seem slight, but what happens is if we don't detect it early, language is a foundation for all of academic achievement. It just is. So science concepts, math concepts, word problems are difficult for these children. Learning how to understand what they read, all of these things are difficult. They have difficulty sometimes learning how to decode words on a page. So it really starts to show up very dramatically in academic achievement. Their teacher will say, pay attention, pay attention. And so they may start to not try as hard, and it becomes a downward spiral.
Right.
And so we're trying to stop that downward spiral. If you have a child now who's in school and struggling, and maybe you've looked at some obvious things, maybe they don't have ADHD, or maybe they do, you know, you're trying to understand why they're having problems, I would encourage you to have their language examined, because it can often be this undercurrent that is driving a lot of differences, and it's not so obvious.
I imagine there's a lot of kids with this who have just slipped beneath the cracks. I mean,
absolutely.
And now they're adults.
Yes. There's some staggering statistics that have come out fairly recently, and some not so recently. For instance, there's a very high population of persons with language disorder that are in the juvenile justice system.
Huh.
The prison population has a very high occurrence of language disorder. There's self-esteem issues associated with this. It runs in families. So that's tricky, too, because you may, you know, you're a parent, you have concerns, and they say, well, just read your child more. Well, maybe you have difficulty reading, and you don't understand what you're reading. So it can be very difficult. And what do when we want to look up information? We look on the internet. We read a ton.
Mm-hmm.
If you have difficulty comprehending complex language, it's not the best way to get information. It can be very tricky. And we also know that, unfortunately, girls who have DLD, we know that later on in their adolescence, in their 30s, they're more likely to have had a sexual assault. So we know that this really has a huge impact. And the mechanism is thought to kind of go like this. Like, they have difficulty learning language. They start to have academic problems. Because they don't have an obvious reason for academic problems, then the teachers and parents tell them, you need to work harder, you need to work harder. Maybe the parents have had problems and they say, I hated school too. So that's just how it is. School's not for us. And so then they start to see themselves as less academic. It starts to limit their choices. They have difficulty negotiating. We use language as our way to communicate. And if you have difficulty communicating, you may not be able to negotiate your social interactions as well. You don't maybe get some of the inside jokes. You can't negotiate with a teacher who tells you something that you don't think is right. You know, we do a lot of negotiation in our life, and that translates to adults too. So negotiating in the workplace, not just negotiating in the narrow sense of something like negotiating a pay raise, but I'm talking about navigating this world. Mabel Rice, who's a strong researcher in language impairments, has talked about this a lot in the family studies she's done, where she follows children to adults, and now she's following their children, is that there's a lot of regret about not being able to really verbally engage with the people around them. And so it really does lead to some pretty negative outcomes. However, on the flip side, if a child does get support early on, we see much more positive outcomes. Mm. They feel they are educated on what this is. They can advocate for themselves. And they have the support to learn the grammatical structures and know how to learn vocabulary and these kinds of things. And we try to intervene early so that we can mitigate some of the self-esteem issues that are associated with it. They're often told they're stupid. And actually, if you look at intelligence tests, they're nonverbal and verbal. And if you give them a verbal intelligence test, it's going to look low. It's the nonverbal that looks typical. And if you average those together, it's going to give a lower performance. We know that DLD is not associated with intellectual disability. It's a separate ability to learn language. And it's not associated with socioeconomic status. So it cuts across all of socioeconomic status from poverty to high levels. And so we know this is an individual difference that cuts across lots of different other individual differences.
Is there like a specific age that is best to intervene for something like DLD?
Ideally, you'd want to intervene early. So preschool level, 3, 4, 5, you know, before they go to school. But definitely by kindergarten is ideal. But I have to say that any time period is a good time to intervene. So because this is a developmental disorder that cuts across the entire lifetime, even if someone is listening and says, I think my child in middle school might have this difficulty, having an evaluation, getting support right now is great. I've been a part of some advocacy campaigns. This was started by a researcher in the UK, Dorothy Bishop, who had studied dyslexia, autism, and developmental language disorder. Mm. And she got very frustrated over time that the public knew about autism, they knew about dyslexia, but no one knew about developmental language disorder. So she started a campaign a few years ago, and it's called Rattle. And we have websites, radld.org, and then we have a dldandme.org website that anyone who's listening who wants to know more can go there. It talks all about how to get evaluation, what it looks like across the lifespan, just trying to get information out to the public. We've had 2 international DLD awareness days. The last one was October 18th. We lit up over 20 monuments across the world in Ireland, UK, Australia, South America. Niagara Falls was even lit up in purple and yellow, the colors of DLD. And it was very exciting to see the awareness that came about. And we had a video campaign. So parents, educators, persons who have DLD could send in videos. Very interesting and heartwarming and sometimes heartbreaking. You're not alone. I mean, this is 5 times more prevalent than autism. If you think about it, it's about 2 in every classroom that we expect to have this difference in language learning. And we really want that to be something that the public knows about.
I mean, just hearing that, it sounds crazy that we know so much about autism. And so it's just mind-blowing to hear that DLD just is not.
I think there's a few factors. One is that it's been called lots of different things.
Huh.
So it was called specific language impairment. It's actually been called childhood aphasia. There was actually a group of researchers that got together and through a process decided we have to have one label. So they came up with the label of developmental language disorder. So that first needed to be done for us to rally around it. I think that was one critical factor. The other factor, I think, is that this has been the purview of speech-language pathologists.
One of the things I keep thinking about is what is the state of speech pathology in schools? Mm-hmm. Are there enough of them? Are the positions filled?
No. I mean, we definitely have overloaded caseloads. You know, and I think they get filled with more obvious types of conditions, to be honest, like speech sound disorder, stuttering, voice problems. You know, we need more speech pathologists in schools so we can have lower caseloads. And I also think speech pathologists need to be more integrated into the general education system. They're often kind of pushed into a room, off in a closet. Okay, you pull your children out that you need to see, and you fix them up, and then you send them back to the classroom. And we as a profession are fighting that because we want to be integrated. Because language, as I said, it permeates all aspects of education. And I think there is some major good progress happening on that front. Speech pathologists are sitting at the table more. They're on literacy teams. They're on screening teams. But we have to push forward, and we have to have more speech pathologists educated. We have to have more of that education focused on academic outcomes and how do we work within school systems to find these children? How do we interface with pediatricians? My pediatrician here in Boston, I'm thrilled. It was one of the reasons I chose this practice. They have speech pathologists in the practice. If I said I had a concern about speech and language development, they say, no problem. Let's schedule an evaluation right now. This is actually very unusual across the nation to have this type of integration, but that's the type of integration we really need to have, and we need to have more funding for speech language services throughout the schools.
When you think about educators, teachers, people working really on those front lines with kids, seeing them every day, what would be one message you'd have for them about DLD that you think is important for them to know?
I think the most important message is children want to do well. Mm. If a child's not doing well, there's typically a reason for that. Assuming that children aren't doing well because they're not academically inclined or they're lazy or they're not trying hard enough, that really never pans out. When you pull those children in who are struggling, there's usually an underlying reason and they need support. It's tricky because these children don't all look the same. They can have, you know, variables in many other areas. And so they're very unique, but they do share a common thread, and that is they have difficulty using and understanding language. So if you have children who you're seeing struggling in your classroom, please work with special educators, speech language pathologists, and get that referral to have them further tested. Because again, a child doesn't want to do poorly. Children are really not lazy. They're really working hard. And we know what children with DLD from the brain imaging studies, they're actually using more of their brain to do less. So it's actually quite an insult to think that they're not trying hard when they're actually trying harder to get less result. Children want to do well, and helping them to do well is really the ultimate goal. And I hope that educators and parents listening will find some inspiration in the advocacy work that we're doing to bring light to this hidden disability.
One of the things I found myself thinking about reading about DLD was the recent reading score dip that everyone has been talking about. And I was curious what you thought about that.
Yes, actually, I'm so glad you asked me this, because in schools, especially with the movement towards more awareness in dyslexia, we're focusing a lot on reading words appropriately. And that is so critical for literacy. You have to be able to read the words on a page. So we need systematic, explicit phonics instruction in the classroom. The evidence base is there. But that's only about, and this is probably an overestimate, 50% of the equation. The other 50% is comprehension and understanding what we read. So you need to be able to read the words on the page, but once you read those words, then the child has to understand those words. And I say they're turned into spoken language, whether you're reading out loud or even reading in your head. That's a spoken language in your head, but you have to be able to understand it. Children with language disorders do not understand language, so they're missing at least 50% of reading comprehension. And because they're not getting those services, it's a major issue. And the schools I work with are recognizing this. I'm working with several districts who have been working very hard to get their word reading instruction ready and good. And they're seeing improvements in word reading, but that doesn't translate automatically to reading comprehension scores. And that's those NAEP scores that everyone's talking about. Those are two abilities. And when you ignore the language comprehension portion of it, then you're not going to see those improvements. There are some great initiatives to improve language comprehension, even in the classroom. I've been a part of one called the Language and mm-hmm. Research Consortium, and we have focused on that comprehension piece from pre-K to grade 3 and beyond. And so I think as we see more awareness for language disorders, more focus on stimulating language in the classroom at the same time that you're working on word reading, then we're going to see those scores improve. But until we have more focus on language comprehension skills, it's not going to improve. And that always strikes me when I see these scores come out. It's always my heart drops a bit, because we're ignoring a huge part of the equation. And I'm glad you asked about it.
And it makes so much sense.
I think there's just a lot of misunderstanding about language comprehension. I've had reading researchers tell me, as long as they can read words, they'll understand it unless they're in poverty. They always assume this is associated with poverty. Children in poverty have the range of language abilities that we see in other groups of children. Some children in poverty learn language quickly, some don't. And we see this across all the SES or socioeconomic statuses. And so it's not just a problem with poverty. It's an individual difference in language comprehension. And we need to think about focusing on those who have that difficulty learning language and comprehending language. And that will help us improve those scores.
How does that look with English as a second language with that group of kids?
That's a great question. Now, that is a struggle right now in terms of identifying language disorders. So children who are learning another language tend to have a slower language development of those languages, but it corrects over time, and that's great. And learning multiple languages is amazing and critical, and I think more children should do that and have the opportunity to do that. Children with language disorders do have difficulty learning that second language. However, we know that we don't want them not to learn a second language, because they're going to have some difficulty, but they're still going to make improvements. So children with language disorders, I should say, are, when I say that low end of normal, they do develop over time. They're just developing at the same rate typically as children who are typical developing, but they're behind. So let's say 2 years behind or something. It's not that easy, but they're still developing language. So if you in the past, speech language pathologists would erroneously tell parents, don't speak another language to your child. They're going to have trouble enough learning one language. Don't add another one to it. This was really not great on so many levels. One, it's not true. They are not hurt by learning another language. They might be a little slower, but then they're still going to learn it. It's just going to take more time. Plus, it really isolated that child further from their culture and their community, not learning that language of their culture and community. But what it does for measurement is it makes it trickier. So when you give an assessment of language, a child who's learning two languages or English as a second language could look like they have a disorder when they're actually just still catching up. So what we do with those children, there's a lot of great research out there now, but what we do is we do more of a dynamic assessment with them. So we test their language, and then we wait just a little bit of time, and then we test it again. And what we'll find is that we look at the slope of growth. So if they're growing as you'd expect, then you say, well, there's not a risk here. Mm-hmm. But if they're not growing as expected, it's flatter development, then you say, oh, there's a risk here. So we use dynamic assessment, and we also use effort rating. So how hard it is for the child or the teacher to teach language. That's another really promising area. So there's a lot of research right now being done in how do we diagnose children with a language disorder that are learning more than one language. And there's some really promising results out there. And dynamic assessment is one of them. Yeah. And I don't want to negate the effect of poverty on educational outcomes.
Right.
That's strong. And for many reasons, many, many, many reasons, nutritional reasons and family reasons. So I don't want to negate that. I just want to make sure that we don't exclude the focus on language differences by focusing only on poverty. We need to focus on both, but it's definitely not the driving factor.
What's it going to take to make that universal screening happen?
Well, it's going to take a lot of advocacy, number one, to get the word out. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about this. We do research on these children, so I'm an NIH-funded researcher. I have these studies in my lab, but we're getting ourselves out more into the community to talk to parent groups, talk to pediatricians, and just get the word out, write for popular press magazines and try to disseminate. It's also going to take some funding. We need more of a focus on policy measures and funding focused on pushing these screeners forward. I think policy is also just such a critical factor. So if we have policy that says we have to screen for language, then it usually happens. So starting with talking to the senators and the policymakers is also another critical aspect that we're trying to move forward on.
Tiffany Hogan is director of the Speech and Language Literacy Lab and professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at MGH Institute, a graduate school founded by Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. She also hosts the See, Hear, Speak podcast. I'm Jill Anderson. This is the Harvard EdCast produced by the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Thanks for listening, and please subscribe.